hereditary privilege and the inheritance of office is fundamentally alien to our nature, and that is what we should remove by removing the monarchy from our constitution. And frankly, waiting for the current holder to die is precisely the hereditary way of doing it. There's an odd kind of paradoxical element of it, being frankly a little bit disrespectful to the lady. But further, we should choose.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. When he was in London recently, Malcolm Turnbull, Australia's most notable Republican, described himself as an Elizabethan. Mr. Turnbull, who led the unsuccessful Yes campaign in the 1999 Republic referendum, has often said since that he doesn't believe the issue will return to the agenda until after the Queen's reign ends. But Bill Shorten says it should be back on the agenda earlier. This weekend, the opposition leader addresses the Australian Republic Movement's dinner in Melbourne. The ARM is pushing for a plebiscite in 2020 to determine the model for a republic, followed by a referendum in 2022. Michael Cooney is the national director of the ARM, and he joins us today to talk about the issues. Michael Cooney, what would becoming a republic mean for Australia?
I think the moment of becoming a republic would mean Australia showing ourselves that we can make changes and we can control our own politics, that it's not all beyond us to make decisions as a nation that improve us. And then I think being an Australian republic, having an Australian presidency and an Australian head of state, I do believe would have a big impact on the relationship between Australian politics and Australian society, and also a big impact on the kind of cohesion and national identity of Australia. Think about it this way. Last century, when this was last debated, the best argument against change was, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And just for the avoidance of doubt, that was a reference to Australian politics, not saying it wasn't broke, right? Whether that was true in the 1990s, I don't think anyone could seriously put their hand on their heart today and say Australian politics isn't broken, or at least breaking badly. And I think that that's because there's the lack of an institution that is dignified and prestigious within our politics. We frankly don't have a queen. The queen lives in England and doesn't play a functioning role in Australia other than as a visitor. The governor generalship's too small, and the prime ministership is this partisan parliamentary institution. On the other hand, we also don't have sufficient symbols of the things that unite us. So I really think if you look at the kinds of roiling debates in our society about identity and meaning and Australian values and citizenship and all those questions, part of the reason for that is that our public symbols symbolise our political divisions through the prime ministership and so on, rather than public political state symbols like a presidency that would show the things that we share.
Now, you talk about symbols. I guess ordinary people are interested in tangible things. Mm. Do you think that being a republic would deliver tangible benefits, for example, in our relationships with some other regional countries?
I don't think the main purpose of a republic is to, you know, put an extra chicken in our pot or things like that. It is a question of identity and of values. I don't think that means it's not relevant to people's ordinary lives, and I don't think that means it's not relevant to daily politics either. When you think about a kind of pyramid of needs analysis of where this issue sits, the traditional analysis was that, you know, people cared most about jobs and Medicare and you know, national security, and this is kind of tip of the pyramid of needs. But if you then look at today's politics and look at today's media debates, even the sort of substantial, tangible issues like employment security or housing are regularly blown off the front page and out of the national conversation by questions about who we are and what that means. So I do think that voters and citizens and Australians, considered in the great mass, not only as a kind of question of politically self-conscious leaders, Australians are talking to each other every day about what it means to be Australian. What do we share? What are we frightened of? What do we agree about? And the republic is part of the answer to that. At the moment, there are these divisive and exclusive patriots who I think are damaging us, and there's not an effective and adequate response, and that's really the republic's role.
Why do you think it's important not to wait for the end of the Queen's reign? Do you think, in fact, that one reason is that change might actually be harder then?
Well, no, I think the reason is because it's not about the Queen's person. The question here is, what do Australians think about our great national institutions? And, you know, the expression un-Australian has, you know, many comic and cliched elements to it. But hereditary privilege and the inheritance of office is fundamentally alien to our nature. And that is what we should remove by removing the monarchy from our constitution. And frankly, waiting for the current holder to die is precisely the hereditary way of doing it. There's an odd kind of paradoxical element of it, being frankly a little bit disrespectful to the lady. But further, we should choose. And when Queen Elizabeth II dies, as is biologically certain, the King of Australia will succeed within hours. In a certain sense, succeed immediately, and will be proclaimed. His succession will be proclaimed within hours. So we don't get to choose unless we become a republic.
This weekend, Bill Shorten speaking to your dinner. Malcolm Turnbull did so last year. What do you expect from the Shorten speech, which is titled "The Pathway to the Republic"?
We're very excited about what the opposition leader is going to say. Last year, the Prime Minister, his main message was twofold. First of all, he restated his support for the Republic movement and restated his call for the Republic movement to become a campaign in the country, a popular campaign of people. That's certainly the journey we're on, to be not just a lobby group or a kind of national association, but to be a campaign, a modern, conversations-oriented, digitally targeted, genuine political campaign with popular support. The second thing the Prime Minister said last year was, we should wait till after the Queen's died. Well, we know that's not the opposition leader's position. And we know he's said in the past that we can make our own decisions, we don't have to wait. And he's spoken, for instance, with great passion about the idea of an Indigenous Australian who could be our head of state and if we had a presidency of our own. So I think we'll hear more of that. And I'm optimistic that the opposition leader is more optimistic about public opinion than the Prime Minister. So I think we're going to hear at least one of our national leaders say something forward-leaning about this issue.
The model is perhaps the most vexed question in this whole Republic debate. The 1999 referendum had a model in which the President, who replaced the Governor-General, would in effect be a bipartisan choice of the Parliament. But now it's likely that the public would want to directly elect a President. What's the ARM's preferred model, and would a directly elected President present problems in our system where considerable power currently rests with the Governor-General, as we've seen historically?
The ARM doesn't have a preferred model. So the ARM's proposal to the Prime Minister and the opposition leader, what we're asking them to do, is to have a national vote in 2020 to answer, where people get a chance to answer two questions. One, do you want an Australian head of state? Yes, no. And secondly, how would you like the Australian head of state chosen? So in effect, elected or appointed. And we support what Australians support in that vote. And that's our view. And there's a diversity of views about people's actual preferences. My chair, Peter Fitzsimons, is on the record as preferring an indirect, the 99 model, effectively. My own views moved a fair way on that in recent years, and I think that a directly elected president is probably in my view, the better way to go. But what unites both Peter and I, and in turn the Republic movement, is the view that Australians should decide. So that should be put to a national vote. And I think that it's not at all a foregone conclusion which direction Australians will want to go in that. But we should give them the voice and give them the chance. And then there's a period of, say, 18 months to 2 years to develop that model into a constitutional amendment proposal for a referendum in 2022.
Well, let's just talk about the directly elected model. Why do you think that that's preferable?
In my personal opinion, first of all, the expectations of Australian citizens for choice and control over their lives have never been higher. People expect to be able to change a flight booking on an app or work out whether they can get a car or a bus in 10 seconds. This sort of a kind of classical era of parliamentary indirect democracies of assemblies and of electoral colleges just doesn't fit the politics of the age. But more than that, I think that Australians are looking for a voice in the system who can speak for them within a system which remains fundamentally a parliamentary government headed by a Prime Minister. We actually need, in my opinion, we need a larger institution. I look, for instance, to the present Governor-General. So he is a very famous Australian, very prominent Australian. He's been Australian of the Year, has been Chief of the Defence Force, has led a major national security intervention, and is famous enough to have been in VB ads. And as Governor-General, that's pretty famous. As Governor, I'm not sure a former Governor-General has been in one. So a couple might have been good buyers, but anyway, I digress. But I can't, in the nature of the role, as hardworking and effective as he is, he's disappeared. I honestly just can't think of the last time I heard his voice, or even particularly saw his face, even around Anzac Day, because the role just doesn't allow you to be large enough. And so in turn, I think that to have a person elected as president who Australians can choose and feel that they speak for and represent them in that best sense of a head of state is precisely the kind of unifying and larger social figure that we really need.
Well, isn't this, though, the core of the problem, or at least the dilemma, that if you have a popularly elected president and he or she has that high profile that you describe, potentially they become a centre of power in their own right?
No, I think they'll be a centre of kind of moral authority, sure, but the system's fairly clear and our expectations of prime ministers won't change. The question is how you get a president rather, this question in a sense is how do you get the best kind of president? And it's a concrete set of alternatives. The alternative is for the parliamentary and party institutions to appoint someone. And I think that would be workable too. But the key point is that it's an engaging conversation for Australians, and Australians might well decide that what they want is their parliament to decide. And in that case, I'm sure that will have great legitimacy in the country too. The key point is to put that question to everyone so that as we move into the phase of debating the issue, Australians have ownership of the system of selection. And in some respects, once you've had that national vote, a parliamentary presidency would also have a similar element of that, you know, that authority of the people.
So can you elaborate a bit on how you think the president's role would be different? Because the Governor-General, while we mightn't hear from him much, is, I think, in fact, pretty busy. Mm. Why we don't hear from him is that what he's doing is not controversial. Mm. So how would you see the president operating?
Well, the president's constitutional functions in relation to the parliament and the cabinet would remain the same. So those kind of, you know, the sort of executive council style functions wouldn't change. But I envisage a prime minister, like if you think about a prime minister going to the grand final, on a good day, 49% of people want to boot him. And on a bad day, some higher proportion. I've lived some of those days. Great to have a president who
in your role as a former ministerial advisor.
Yes. When I was working for Julia Gillard, some days there were more than 49% of people in might have booed us at the grand final. But it'd be great to have a president who could go there and be everyone's. And I similarly think of that very characteristic Australian requirement of a person to represent the government and all Australians to visit a natural disaster area. And prime ministers of both sides turn up at these things, and they go there for some practical reasons to see that things are working and to make. And have meetings with state premiers, but they also go there to express something for the nation. And the truth is, all of us look at them rather cynically when they do that, and we see them sort of go in for the hug with the person who wants a hug and kind of get their shoulder out of the way because you wouldn't want to miss the photo and stuff like that. And at best, 49% of people are thinking grumble, grumble, grumble. It'd be good if someone represented all of us in that moment and could speak for all of us in that moment. You know, Anzac Day becomes a succession of speeches by parliamentarians rather than a day on which someone can speak in a larger and more comprehensive way.
Nevertheless, the sharp end of all this is the powers of the head of state, the representative in a crisis. And there's been a lot of discussion that if we move to an Australian head of state, their powers would have to be codified. At present, you have reserve powers, but so they're not spelled out. But as we saw in 75, there's a power to dismiss a government. Would the president's power have to be codified?
The short answer is I think that's a question to work through in detail in 2020 once you've first of all established the question in principle of how a president's being chosen. I think that those questions need to be considered together, and you've got to let Australians choose how a president's chosen first, and then you need some detailed work to work to that. But no, I don't think it necessarily requires codification. We broadly envisage that the presidency would function in broadly the same way as it does, as the Governor-Generalship does today. And it's worth noting that, you know, the Governor-General's exercise of those powers hasn't been uncontroversial in history, as you say. It's not as if the present system is a kind of a Swiss clock that never fails, and that if we touch it, it'll go bad. Quite the contrary, in fact. So, no, I think that's fundamentally a question for once you've worked out whether you want to elect it or appoint a presidency, then you can work out the best method to translate their constitutional function.
Just to go back to the question of timing, obviously, if there was a Labor government after the next election, the cause would be pushed forward. But in practical terms, isn't it really dependent on the slowest player? And that means that the coalition has a big effect on the timing, whether in government or opposition.
Well, it's certainly not a project of one party or another and can't be for it to be a successful national change. I couldn't agree more. So at the moment we have a Prime Minister and an opposition leader who both support an Australian Republic. Every state Premier and Chief Minister, Labor and Liberal, support an Australian Republic. That's actually quite a good time to make the move. And our ideal situation for the ARM would be, and in turn for an Australian Republic, would be if the Prime Minister and the opposition leader both ran into the next election promising a national ballot in 2020 on the issue. It requires two things, it seems to me. We need leadership from the Prime Ministership and the political system, and then also we need an effective conversations-based community campaign, and those things need to go together. Like it's not a question of one or the other. They'll reinforce each other and lead each other. But absolutely, the fundamental question in terms of timing and getting this thing moving requires a Prime Minister, Labor, Liberal, whatever, to put the issue up for serious consideration. So, you know, the Prime Minister's been clear that he'll give that some thought following the death of the Queen. Saying that in the 1980s was a big deferral. Saying that today, with all due respect, isn't quite the deferral that it might seem.
Mind you, Prime Ministers come and go pretty quickly
these days. The actuarial lifespan of an English woman the age of Queen Elizabeth II is 4.5 years. And you make a reasonable point about the actuarial lifespan of an Australian Prime Minister in this century. But the truth is, yeah, it's not, you know, whether it's considered following the death of the Queen or in 2020 or whenever, this issue must be considered. And it needs both a Prime Minister and a popular campaign coming together. Yeah, I agree.
But there's another complication, isn't there, that within the coalition, even though Malcolm Turnbull might be a Republican, there are a lot of non-Republicans, and they are going to inevitably, whenever the time comes, slow this process down.
Well, I think in turn that's one of the reasons why what's required is a popular campaign to really establish where popular sentiment is. But I'd also say that Republican sentiment in the coalition certainly isn't limited to the Prime Minister. Premier Berejiklian in New South Wales, Premier Hodgman in Tasmania, both Liberal premiers who are leaders. There's a bipartisan parliamentary friendship group in Canberra. There are growing friendship groups around the country that are bipartisan in the state parliaments. And there are many more undeclared coalition MPs and declared Republican MPs than there are declared Conservative MPs, you know. And by no means all from one part of the Liberal Party either, you know. George Christensen and Kevin Andrews are both slated Republicans. So there's a lot of bipartisanship in this, and it's certainly a campaign which, both from the ARM level and its engagement with the community, is strongly focused on an inclusive campaign.
We've seen a relatively simple thing, you would think, recognition of Indigenous people in the Constitution being deferred and derailed, essentially. Do you feel that the difficulties with constitutional change are so great these days that we either never get round to it or people are inclined to vote no regardless?
I mean, the tail of the tape is it's been a while since a successful constitutional change, that's true. I think that actually is all the more reason why what's required is that combination of leadership and popular campaigning. And I also think it's why a number of these campaigns actually need to all pull forward together rather than thinking about some careful sequence of who goes first and whose year it is and so on. I actually think that momentum is good for everyone's progress. But there's no doubt it does require clear leadership. Like we've heard the Prime Minister's position and he may expand on that further in the next 18 months before the next election. But it's going to require leadership whether for any of these campaigns. And that's a big part of our role, is to call for that leadership, but also to exhibit that leadership at a community level.
Critics of the Australian Republic movement have raised concerns that while it's supposed to be bipartisan, it seems to be somewhat left-leaning. Do you have any concern about that, or do you acknowledge that criticism?
Oh, I know people say that, but I don't think that's the case. I mean, our chair, Peter Fitzsimons, could fairly be described as politically eclectic. Probably his best friend in national politics would have been Joe Hockey. And indeed, Joe Hockey made a significant intervention in the Republic debate in recent years. Obviously now out of parliamentary politics, but prominent in Australia. And Fitzsimons, on the other hand, is also Kim Beazley's biographer. Thinking about the organisation, you know, obviously I've got a background in Labor politics and my campaign director, Sandy Byers, got a strong background in Liberal politics. And across the board, our National Committee and other institutions are member-controlled and they're, you know, elective. And like I say, we're really heartened by the continued strong kind of recent public statements. So, for instance, around Australia Day this year, all the state premiers and chief ministers at that time, with the exception of the WA premier, joined a public statement. And so I think there's really clear basis for saying that there are many Republicans across the board. And it is clearly, my background's obvious in Labor politics. In the end, if you're going to have political professionals run a professional campaign, they're going to come from one side or the other. And we've got them from both sides. So I think that's important.
Just finally, do you think one problem for the Republic push is that the young royals have become popular celebrity figures? And how do you counter that? People rather like them?
Yeah, they're an impressive young group. I mean, I suppose, my favourite's Harry, and we're not going to get him out of the hereditary principle. I reckon his visit to the Invictus Games next year will be quite an impressive event. Australians know the difference between celebrity and the constitution and between the media consumption of these people as personalities and where we sit as a country, I think. And, American magazines report on these people too. I think that that's, they're clearly more popular than the heir apparent. That's a fact. But the question that is put to Australians about here is our politics actually working? Do we have functioning symbols that unite us? Do we know what it means to be Australian? Are we comfortable with people who settle here and people who are born here and people whose families have been here for 1,000 generations? Do we all actually have enough in common to make this thing work together? And is politics actually fine? Or do we really actually need to do something? And I think when you put that serious question, I don't have any doubt that people who are either great admirers of Queen Elizabeth II's remarkable public career, or for that matter, who are quite taken by Harry's combat record or whatever, that admiration isn't affected by a decision we make about how we run our affairs. And we fundamentally need to take back control of our system and make something work better here, because there are real problems that we have now, and they're crystallising now. They're not potential problems, they're problems about our society and politics today.
Michael Cooney, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage, and we'll be back with another interview soon. Goodbye for now.